Good evening and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALWFM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Josh Borger and I'll be serving as your host for the night. And tonight's topic is disability law. What laws protect people with disabilities in the workplace? If you're disabled, what are your rights in the workplace? And if you're the employer employing someone who's disabled, what do you need to do to ensure that they can do their job? Tonight's guests are, first off, Michael Wilson Jr., who's a shareholder in the San Francisco office of Ogletree Deacons Nash Smoke and Stewart. He helps clients in the construction, tech, retail, restaurant, cannabis, and hospitality industries navigate the complexities of the ever-changing labor and employment landscape. Michael partners with in-house counsel, corporate executives, and HR representatives to provide advice and counsel on updating company policies, investigating workplace disputes, and developing workplace trainings which address unconscious bias and changing social factors, all designed to minimize the potential of future claims. In other instances, he counsels clients on best practices for compliance with wage and hour laws, leave of absence requests, data privacy issues, reductions in force, and pandemic response. If litigation is warranted, Michael has over a decade of experience litigating single plaintiff, multi-plaintiff, and class action lawsuits in state and federal court and before administrative agencies. And our second guest is Kelly Armstrong, who's a leading employment discrimination attorney in San Francisco for 20 years and is rated as a super lawyer in the top 5% in Northern California. She only represents employees. Her cases have been featured in the local and national media and print, radio, and television. Kelly has generated millions of dollars for her clients and is a frequent speaker and published author, including for disability discrimination, wrongful termination, and sexual harassment. Michael and Kelly, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Josh. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
As always, we're eager to hear what our listeners have on their mind and to answer their questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. And again, that's 415-841-4134. And if you're in the Bay Area, and if you're outside of the local dialing area, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Our attorney guests cannot give you specific legal advice as they don't have all the salient facts of your situation, but they're happy to share legal principles to help you guide your decision-making. Feel free to call them with questions wherever we are at that time in our conversation. So starting off, why don't we ask the more general question, what does it actually mean to be disabled at work?
Well, California has some of the most, if not the most, employee-friendly laws in the country. So the definition of a disability at work is construed extremely broadly in California and includes just about anything but for minor things such as a common cold, non-migraine headaches, bumps and bruises, aches and pains. But almost anything in California can reach the level required to be a disability.
So it is not just a physical disability. It could be a mental disability. It could be anything, in essence, that is impacting your ability to do your job.
Right. I mean, employees who have disabilities, the reason they come forward is that they feel that they are unable to do their jobs unless they have some type of an accommodation, or unless they receive treatment or take a leave, take a complete leave.
And so this could be something temporary, such as treatment for cancer, or something long-term, such as you need accommodations because you have a bipolar disorder and you can do your job, but with certain accommodations. Is that fair?
Yeah, it can be both short and long-term, and it can also be intermittent. So someone may need an accommodation for their disability and need treatment in cycles. And so they're at work for a month, and then they need a time off for the treatment and the accommodation, and they're back for a month. Or intermittent could also be that the accommodation and the leave that the employee needs could be determined as each month or week goes by in conjunction with their doctor. but you know, employers have a very high, strong responsibility to engage in a good faith interactive process with the employees to try to make their best effort to accommodate them, whether it's short term, long term, or intermittently.
And the great part about this panel is that, correct me if I'm wrong, but you do mostly or solely plaintiff work. Michael, your focus is more on representing the businesses, the employers. Is that correct?
Yep, that's correct. And so I normally want to help them or counsel them on how to navigate this process for employees as needed.
So let me ask this question, and we'll phrase it differently, but I think we're getting at the same thing. What are the rights that a disabled employee has? What are the accommodations that they have to give? And I'd be curious of both of your answers to see what they are from the employee's perspective and the employer's perspective.
Well, from the employer's perspective, the employer is going to try to grant what's called a reasonable accommodation. So depending on what that means, right? If it means, hey, I have a disability where maybe I need a sit-stand desk or a chair, that may be an easier accommodation to sort of handle. Whereas if it sometimes it may be something as the employee needs to take time off to go receive treatment and just altering that employee's schedule. But from the employer's perspective, it's saying, look, we have a valued member of the workforce. How do we ensure that that person can still perform the essential functions of his or her job? Recognizing that because of a disability, we may have to make some tweaks to how their schedule and their and how they carry out those functions.
And, you know, an employee has the right to be accommodated, and disability complaints are more the of all of the discrimination complaints that people make to the EEOC and the California counterpart, the DFEH, the majority, the highest percentage of those complaints are disability discrimination. So it is our most common area in the discrimination world. And so millions of employees become disabled and need accommodations throughout their employment. And an employee has the right to request an accommodation from their employer. And the bar for an employee to place the employer on notice that they have a disability and need an accommodation is actually very low. So it's important that employers are affirmatively responsible for trying to be proactive in helping their workforce if they need accommodations and things like that. But an employee has the right to request it, and they also, it's often best if they have a doctor's note that is stating that they need an accommodation for X amount of time, and that's something that starts the process with the employer going back and forth in terms of trying to come up with a reasonable accommodation that helps the employee, but also doesn't create an undue hardship on the employer.
And if I may tag on real quick, Kelly said something that I thought is important. While an employer always wants to see if they can find a reasonable accommodation for their employees and for their workforce, it's important to remember that if you have a disability and you don't speak up, you don't go to HR to request that, it can't be expected that the employer should be on notice. And sometimes, and I agree with Kelly, there's a lot of claims in this space, but sometimes an employee, let's just say that they got hurt over the weekend, and maybe they're limping. They come to work and they're limping. Well, again, that may be something minor, but if it's something that is actually a disability requiring an accommodation, the fact that you're limping around the office may give some coworkers pause to say, hey, what happened? But the employer, to be on notice, you still need to come and make that request. And many times employers struggle with the fact that they're not necessarily certain about everything that's going on with every single employee. You know, they're trying to run a business on a day-to-day basis, but that's why they try to have HR, they try to have avenues for employees to make that request, so that way the employer can go through the interactive process.
So if an employee starts working and the employee is very clearly handicapped that we could all see and doesn't say anything, doesn't want to be treated differently, does the employer have a duty to ask if they need accommodations, to raise the issue?
I don't think so. If the employee doesn't want an accommodation and wants to maintain their medical and disability privacy.
Right, and Kelly's spot on. And I think the other thing that's important to note is that employers can get in trouble for assuming that somebody needs something and maybe accidentally or inadvertently veering into the territory of asking an employee about their medical situation, which normally employers stay away from. So if someone is, quote, handicapped, that everyone can see it, but that employee can perform the essential functions of his or her job and never makes a request, that is fine. There's no need to have that discussion. There's no need to engage. And more importantly, from the employer's perspective, there's no need to venture into that risky territory of asking, hey, do you need something?
That the bank recently, and the bank teller said very kindly to the person in front of me, congratulations, you're pregnant. And she said, I'm not. So you don't need to actually have that conversation with somebody because it leads to terrible consequences. Understand. Right.
There's also a category of perceived disability. So an employer and management at a company could perceive that an employee has a disability. And even if they don't, if the person perceives that they have a disability and treats them differently and in a disparate manner because of that perception, that could also give rise to a claim. So employers want to be careful about not acting differently towards employees because they think they might have something such as residual effects of chemotherapy after cancer, etc. And so employees can also come forward to attorneys for advice, etc., if they believe they're being treated differently based on a perceived disability also.
Right. And to that end, one thing I'll add is most employers nowadays, when they are interviewing a candidate for a position, and let's say that they extend an offer of employment and it's wonderful, everything's wonderful, they may ask, in addition to sending the offer of employment, saying, hey, you know, congratulations, but are there any accommodations that you may need? So that may be the one sort of exception where at the very beginning of the employment relationship, to the extent that the employee has something that he or she would like the employer to know in advance, they may disclose it at that time. And that's one of the few instances where an employer may ask ahead of time. But again, once the employee's on board, is a part of the workforce, if something changes in the future and they need an accommodation, then again, going to HR, going to the appropriate person to make that request is kind of how that would work.
Now, what happens if you and your employer cannot agree on the reasonable accommodation that you need?
Well, that's very challenging. The employer needs to make a genuine effort over time, going back and forth with different communications, conversations, written communication, etc. And the employee can also work with their doctor to see if they can find something that would be a modified accommodation from where they originally started. But then we need to analyze, you know, is what the employee is asking for completely unreasonable? You know, if an employee is saying that they need to work from home instead of the office as an accommodation, want to work from home 100%, but their job requires them to do outside sales or participate in face-to-face meetings frequently, that's not going to be reasonable. You know, so it's a reasonable test and it's taken on a case-by-case basis. But frequently what you see happen is, you know, I understand why so many employers become frustrated when employees become disabled and need long leaves, et cetera, and are affected by illness and disabilities and things like that. Because employers are trying to continue to be successful and organized and conduct business in a smooth manner. So it's hard to find a balance, but typically what we see, at least from the people that we talk to, is that very quickly, employers will often start acting in a way which makes the employee feel alienated, regardless of what type of accommodation they're asking for. So I think it's really important for employees to make sure that they have all of the communications from them and between them and the employer documented. You know, perhaps we'll get into that later. But we see very quickly employers not trying very hard to accommodate. So I would say in 20 years, it's very rare that I've come across a circumstance where what the employee was asking for was too much, because so often the employer quickly terminates a disabled employee after saying that they had poor work performance.
I was going to chime in on that because that's a very good question. You know, from the employer's perspective, I think one thing that many, you know, employers and business owners can appreciate and they'll empathize is when an employee comes and asks for an accommodation, right? The employer normally values that person and wants to keep them on, preferably in the position that they're in. And to your question, what do they do if they can't agree on it? Well, remember, the employer is trying to find a reasonable accommodation. And while Kelly is right that in many instances, a reasonable accommodation can be found, right? It may mean, again, altering the schedule. Sometimes it may be working from home, depending on the position or doing certain things. Employers many times face issues where an employee with a legitimate disability will ask for modifications to the job that are not reasonable. Here's a good example. The employee may be disabled, but then realizes, I don't like my supervisor, so I want my supervisor changed. Well, wait a minute. That does not have to do with accommodating your ability to come to work and perform your essential functions. You have a personal issue maybe with a supervisor or with a department that you don't want. And that's where, from my client's perspective, there sometimes is that trouble where it's like, hey, we're ready to have you, you know, maybe modify your schedule, have you do something, but you want to make personnel decisions or you'll, I've seen instances, my clients have seen instances where a disabled employee will go out on leave and come back and say, I need that person fired before I return. Well, that's not a reasonable accommodation. And you would be surprised how often my clients will field complaints from the DFEH or the EEOC where someone is making this allegation. And of course, they don't put it that way. But when you look into the facts, you realize, well, they weren't asking for a reasonable accommodation. They weren't asking to still perform the essential functions. They were trying to do something more. And so those are the instances where, yeah, there's definitely not going to be an agreement and something else needs to be done.
Let me take your hypothetical a little further.
Sure.
Because it's not illegal to have an obnoxious boss. We learned this in law school. You can't discriminate based on certain categories, but if your boss is a screamer, an obnoxious person, your response is to quit your job and find a better one. But it's not illegal. So what if somebody has anxiety or a mental disorder, a disability, if you will, excuse me, and working for someone who does behave in that manner triggers something with that disability? Can they come back and say, I can't work for that supervisor because it's not reasonable given what I have?
So as you noted earlier, everything is on a case-by-case basis. I'm not saying that could never happen, but I'll wrap that answer into your prior question. Sometimes providing a reasonable accommodation is saying, okay, we're going to have you actually do a different job. Now, ideally, they're going to, you know, from an employer's perspective, again, valuing the workforce, they may try to find an employee a job. Maybe it's in a different department or with a different supervisor where maybe the pay is the same. But sometimes that a reasonable accommodation, depending on the circumstance, may require putting you in another open position that maybe you're not making as much. And that's another instance where the employee feels like, well, that's not the accommodation I want. But that may be the employer saying, hey, look, if you're triggered by this person and there is, you know, we've got documentation and there's a real issue here, but again, we value you, we want to keep you on. That may be a rare instance where it's like, well, maybe we place you in a different position, maybe in a different department if we can, but it may also lead to other changes. And many times employees are not prepared for that.
And I would also add on to what Michael is saying is that obviously the larger the employer is, the more able they would be to come up with different options in terms of a different department for the employee to work in, et cetera. But it's pretty rare that an employer will actually agree to change someone's supervisor. But as Michael was saying, it's not that it could never happen, but it's very rare. But in a circumstance where a particular supervisor was causing an employee so much anxiety that they were unable to perform their job duties, et cetera, many private employers have short-term disability or STD benefit plans, and many of those plans pay 60 to 66% of an employee's compensation. And for higher level executives, they often pay more. And I've seen them go all the way up to 100%. So in the scenario that Josh was describing with the employee having so much anxiety, I would recommend that they work with their medical providers and see if the medical providers recommend that they go out on a disability leave for more treatment and healing, and then apply for those benefits and go through that process, and then think about whether it's in their best interest to perhaps work for a completely different employer. And I'd also say employers value their employees. That's why they're employed there. But once employees become disabled, and the longer that they're disabled, especially if they're out on leave completely, as more time goes by, the employer learns how to survive without them and often begins to value them less and less over time. And that's, of course, where people like Michael and I step in.
Now, there's probably going to be a difficult balancing act between reasonable accommodation, and at some point, the accommodation goes to the point that you really took away the essential functions of the job. You accommodated them so much so that what you hired them for, they're not doing anymore. So at what point can the employer say, look, I can't meet any accommodation or anything you deem reasonable, and you think they're insulated from a lawsuit, because by doing what they want or what anyone would consider reasonable, you take away the functions of the job?
Well, what I would say on that is two things, and I work with employers on that because, and I'm sure Kelly will agree with me on this, if you accommodate an employee to the point that you're removing all of their essential functions, but you're still allowing them to sort of be in that position, well, it makes it a lot harder in the future to say, well, I couldn't accommodate them. And on some levels, you've taken away your argument that the functions are essential, right? You've kept the employee in the same position. You've allowed them to do that. So the key thing is during the early interactive process, really understanding, am I making sure that this employee can do the essential functions now, today, with whatever accommodation they're requesting? And sometimes, yes, it may be removing an essential function for a week or two, something like that. But if it's going to be longer, that is when the accommodation has to be a little more expansive. And that's where the conversation is going to be a little more expansive, because it may make sense to put an employee in a different position where you are not removing the essential functions, because again, an employer can get into a lot of trouble later on. It's better to upfront say, okay, maybe this is not the position for you. Here's this other open position over here. We'll slide you in there where with your disability, you're able to perform all the essential functions of that new position. And then now maybe you're hiring for someone for this other vacancy. And that's probably the cleanest way to do it. But if you remove it and you keep them in that position for a year or something like that, well, if the employer gets frustrated, the employer's gotta take responsibility, because you've already kind of proven that you can function with this sort of changed arrangement.
Also, most employers aren't large enough to be able to put someone in a different department, et cetera. But I mean, at the point where you take away the majority or all of someone's essential job duties, that employee is in a position to argue constructive discharge and allege that they're no longer developing professionally, their career is going to be hindered, et cetera. So it's pretty unwise for an employer to do something like that. And if an employee is experiencing that, they can consult and determine whether or not that gives rise to a claim.
We have a caller.
Disability discrimination.
Sure. We have a caller. Mark from San Francisco is on the line. Mark, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. I wonder if an employee informs the employer about a disability, do they essentially make themselves unfireable with an employer fearing a lawsuit?
Sure, and thank you for your question. So putting an employer on notice that an employee has a disability will create a degree of protection. I mean, nothing is ever ironclad, I think, in our world, but it will create a degree of protection. And if an employee told an employer that they had a disability and then the employer terminated them right away, there could be a strong argument that that was per se discriminatory. But there are many other responsibilities that an employee has besides just notifying the employer that they have a disability if they do indeed want an accommodation. And so an employee should always try to have things in writing, and so they should put their requests in email or some other type of writing, Slack, however they generally communicate with managers. It doesn't always have to be HR. It can also be a manager in above a particular employee in their department. But, I mean, an employee needs to notify management of their disability, let them know if they need an accommodation, and that will start off the process. The employee doesn't have to give all of the information at that time, but in addition to the notification, a request for an accommodation, and then that will shift the burden to the employer to engage in a good faith interactive process to try to accommodate the employee.
And I'll add on that again, every situation, you've got to look at all the facts. The other thing I would say is, when does that employee tell you that they have a disability? One of the things that some of my clients face is maybe they have an employee who's not performing and maybe has received verbal warnings, written warnings, and maybe they're getting called into a meeting to be put on a performance improvement plan. And it is only after months of sort of poor performance or longer that the employee then blurts out in a meeting, oh, by the way, I have a disability. Now, yes, I would never counsel my client to, any client or any employer to fire someone in that instance. You would still go through the interactive process, determine if some accommodation is needed. But that doesn't mean that certain personnel functions should not still go through. Now, they may need to be modified, right? If it's justifiable, and again, going through that interactive process, it depends on the facts. But in that instance, you would want to work with the employee and determine whether or not indeed the poor performance is truly tied to a disability that maybe for whatever reason they didn't bring up before. But it doesn't make the employee unfireable. It just means that the employer needs to be very careful and make sure that they're not discriminating, make sure they're going through the interactive process, but still making sure that that employee is held to the same standard, generally speaking, as all other employees. And so if down the road that means, hey, you know, this employee is still not performing, even though we provided an accommodation, there may be a justifiable, legitimate reason for terminating that employee at that time. But again, it depends on all the facts.
So if an employee with a disability who needs an accommodation perceives that they're experiencing some hostility from their employer for getting the accommodation or anything else, any type of hostility, what does the employee do there? And if they report it, what does the employer do in response? They may disagree that they were being hostile.
Well, one good thing that an employee can do that would be helpful for that type of scenario is to send an email to HR management or their manager, which says, I believe that I'm being targeted because I have a disability or it's perceived that I have a disability. What can be done to protect me? So just those two simple sentences is considered protected activity. And if an employee did that, management would have a responsibility to look into it and try to address the issue. And then if the employee was terminated soon after sending an email like that, it would create an inference of retaliation under California and federal law. And it's actually a lot easier to prove retaliation than discrimination in many instances.
And what I would add is that from the employer perspective, you know, many employers have confidential hotlines. They're definitely, you can send an email, you can go to HR. And I guess I would make that question a little bit broader. It depends on who they're perceiving the discrimination from, right? Saying the employer is kind of broad. If it's from that employee's direct manager, going to another manager, going to HR, maybe making a complaint via the hotline. So that way the employer's on notice and the employer can do an investigation. And when an investigation is undertaken, at the end of that, there will normally be a discussion whether or not that finding is substantiated, because if it is, maybe the employer is going to discipline that supervisor and say, hey, you know, you treat everyone with respect. Or if it's not substantiated, normally an employer will give a reminder to everyone involved. Hey, this is a workplace where we respect everyone. We are not going to retaliate. We're not going to treat anyone different. And we keep the lines of communication open just to make sure that, you know, that employee feels respected and doesn't feel targeted. Because again, the employer at the end of the day wants to engage in the business it's designed for. It does not want to fend off lawsuits, right? It wants to try to avoid that. And so it will take, it'll use its tools to try to do that.
A good employer wants to try to do that. But let me also add that in so many instances, disabled employees are terminated based on alleged poor work performance, even if their work performance was fine before they developed a disability or needed an accommodation or wanted to go on leave. So I would recommend that if an employee is going to come forward and place their employer on notice of a disability and a need for an accommodation, that they should make copies of any emails, other documentation, Slacks, text messages, etc., which to have positive comments about their work performance.
And on that note, thank you very much, both of you. We do need to take a station break, and we'll be back in a minute.
2020 was a pretty busy year for Jake Tapper. He's an anchor on CNN, so the pandemic and presidential election kept him pretty busy. But somehow he found the time to write a novel. Jake will explain how writing a thriller gave him a break from politics. It's coming up on Q from PRX.
Q Finish CBC will be next at 7 o'clock, followed by All Songs Considered at 8 o'clock here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We are member-supported radio. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org.
And we're back on Your Legal Rights. Feel free to give us a call if you have any questions at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 if you're in the Bay Area or if you're outside of the local dialing area, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. I want to ask you both a question, which... some time ago, I believe I was reading about some people for accommodations are seeking pets, and it's gone far beyond their dog. I've read about everything from a bird on somebody's shoulder to somewhat perceived to be exotic animals. What is there a rule at this point on this, on how far you can go as far as the pets that your employer needs to accommodate?
Well, I will start and say that's a great question. I think there's still some work to be done in that space, but let me start here. You know, again, everything's taken on a case-by-case basis. Employers also have to comply with a myriad of other rules, right? And that could be everything from Cal OSHA to just certain rules, depending on the industry in terms of, let's say that you work in the agriculture food industry. Well, your employer is not likely going to be able to allow you to have, like, you know, a comfort pig come and help or a peacock, because there may be other health issues at play. So again, it's an individual basis, but yes, employers can definitely do that. And while it's not exactly the same, people may have heard about the fact that airlines, right, an industry where you many times have to accommodate passengers, they started putting the curb on having dogs or certain other types of animals because it creates a health hazard. Sometimes other employees get hurt. And one thing that should be noted is that whether you're traveling on an airline or you're seeking accommodation at your job, part of having a reasonable accommodation is not putting other employees at risk of bodily injury or creating an unsafe space. And so that is definitely going to be a huge part of the analysis.
And I also think that, you know, anything is possible in California. So I've spoken with people before that said, well, you know, why don't you come move to Texas or Florida? And there's no way that I would be able to do or practice law in the manner that I do in California in those types of states. And so I think that because anything is possible in California with our overwhelmingly favorable employee laws, if an employee wanted to have something such as an emotional support rat or bird or rabbit or turtle, etc. I mean, I think that in addition to what Michael was saying, as so long as it didn't create an unsafe work environment, I think so long as someone having an emotional support animal as an accommodation for their disability, so long as it didn't interfere with other employees' ability to perform their jobs, if it wasn't too distracting, too noisy, et cetera. I mean, imagine if someone was allowed to bring in an animal for support, that initially a lot of employees would be excited and checking out the animal, et cetera. But over time, things would calm again. And frankly, if something such as a small animal that can be contained within a smaller area, within an employee's own workspace, if something like that will make a big difference and allow, because it's, as we all know, it's extremely difficult to find a very good employee. And if the employer values the employee, might be willing to accommodate something like that, especially if that allows the employee to continue being as productive as they were before they developed a disability.
So my emotional support Siberian tiger idea is out.
Probably.
You know, I think to use Kelly's word, if you, since you're in California, it's a case by case basis. Maybe, but it's not my
case. I was thinking I'd bring him to a jury and just told 12 jurors he hasn't eaten in days. How do you want to vote?
Yeah. I mean, even in Texas, they're having issues with that tiger, you know?
That's right. True. I don't know if they caught that one. But you could have, and I don't mean this facetiously, but someone could have something they consider emotional support, not an animal, that other people find offensive for any number of reasons. Somebody could have a naked photo of somebody. It could be any number of things you could spin out that another person in the workplace would find unbelievably offensive. They may be right. They may not be. It could violate religious principles, any number of things. And I guess the employer is then in that very uncomfortable position of trying to find that middle ground between balancing everyone's rights.
Right. I mean, and that's a key point, right? I think many times employees, understandably, if they're coming and they're seeking an accommodation, they are only worried about themselves, right? And I get that. But from the employer's perspective, there's this balancing act that is happening every single day. And so because of privacy rights, the average employee may have no idea how many different, you know, types of accommodations are being maintained while also trying to run a business, while also trying to comply with a whole series of laws. And so I think it's a good thing to put out there that, you know, employees should understand that as well. And there's a balancing act, right? And you know, what may work in terms of one employee's accommodation request may be vastly different and may explain why that one employee can be accommodated while another one, you know, maybe the accommodation can't be accommodated because it's maybe unreasonable, or why maybe something very different is needed to deal with that situation.
So did we bridge a gap where you two are suddenly feeling sympathetic to the other one's clients? Have we gotten? No, guess not. You're both laughing at me.
I'll never go to the dark side.
All right. We haven't gotten there yet. All right. We're not done yet. We've got time. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Show's not over. So
let's move on. I will say this, right? I think one thing for me as a labored employment attorney is, look, I'm an employee. So I've worked in a host of industries from, you know, my first job, you know, working at the Boys and Girls Club, you know, in the games room, to, you know, being a travel agent, to doing a host of things, and then now being an attorney. And I'm always sensitive to that, right? I'm always sensitive to an employee because I think about that person as, you know, it could be a family member, it could be me. But I also counsel my clients that way, right? And that's the reason why my clients, you know, again, there's a lot of balancing, but they value that person who's coming in seeking an accommodation, but they're also putting themselves in that position, and they try to, you know, handle that situation as needed when it's reasonable.
Fair enough. So let's move on to a little bit of a different topic. What financial disability benefits are available for employees who need to take a leave of absence?
Well, it varies from employer to employer. So some employers have the private STD or short-term disability benefit plans. And some employers have nothing, in which case people can apply for SDI benefits through the EDD. And the maximum weekly benefit there is in between $1,200 and $1,300, significantly more than the weekly maximum unemployment benefit. So there are those two benefits. And then many employers will allow for paid leave for some employees, whether they need to take time off for personal reasons or for a disability, et cetera. So you see a big combination. And oftentimes when people apply for the SPD benefits, they also need to concurrently apply for the SDI benefits through the EDD, and then they'll be receiving both of those benefits at the same time. It really varies from employer to employer, and also what that employer can afford.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I agree. I totally agree with everything you said. It could be a package.
See, I knew you two would agree on something. You called told you. Give it time. Give it time. Now, you may disagree on the next one here, but probably not. How long can a disabled employee go on leave, and how do they ensure that their job is safe when they get back? Or does the employer have to keep it open for them for no matter how long they're on leave?
So an employee can go on initially for FMLA, there need to be at least 50 employees at the employers. And in California, the law just changed January 1st. So if an employer has a minimum of 5 employees, they need to provide relief to the employees, which is a California parallel for the FMLA. So an employee can go out for 12 weeks of protected leave. And after that, if their doctors continue to extend their medical notes for their leave, they can go on a general FEHA disability leave for quite a long time. The test is whether or not the employee's being out on leave for an extended period of time creates an undue hardship for the employer. And so the larger that the employer is, the more employees that they have, the harder it is for those employers to argue that it creates an undue hardship. The smaller the employer is, obviously, the easier. But it's very complicated. But I have seen employers allow employees to stay on leave for over 2 years. I have seen multiple corporate employers allow them to stay on leave for at least a year or a year and a half. And again, you know, as Michael would describe, it's on a case by case basis in terms of the size of the employer, the nature of the employer's work, how essential that employee is, to that employer's business, et cetera. But the longer that an employee is out on leave, and I don't recommend that employees go out on leave for a long time, because I find that the longer that people aren't functioning in a normal way, the harder it is for them to get back to normal. And I see that people actually become worse in terms of functioning on a normal level the longer that they're out on disability leave. And the longer that employees are out on disability leave, the employers learn how to survive without them. And so they can divide up their job responsibilities among other employees and see very easily that they can survive without this employee. So the longer that an employee stays out on leave, regardless of what the policies are, the more their job is going to be at risk. So I don't recommend that employees stay out for a long time if they're able to find a way to somehow get better and get back into the workplace.
Yeah, from the employer's perspective, and I think more importantly from California law, you can't have an unlimited leave. It can't be forever. It can't just be until, you know, just some sort of, you know, you have no idea when that person's coming back, because again, employers are trying to run a business. They're trying to make sure that everything is handled. And more importantly, depending on the employee that's out, sometimes, yes, there's a holding down the fort sort of situation, but sometimes employers have to be strategic and they have to shift how they're going to run their operations depending on what else is going on in the market and all these other things. I bring that up to say that yes, employees, if an employee has to take sort of, you know, up to 12 weeks or whatever it is on for FMLA leave because of a disability, they have protected leave. And then yes, if they need more time for treatment, for example, if somebody maybe has cancer treatments and maybe they need a little more time, yes, there may be further unpaid leave, but that's not protected leave anymore. And so while the employer is still going to try to see if they can do it. One of the things that does happen in this environment, and 2020 was a really good example of this, is that you had a shock to the system. You had employers that were trying to navigate their businesses before. You had the shock to the system. And then employers had to be nimble, and they had to restructure. And sometimes restructuring will lead to saying, okay, do we really need this position, or can we consolidate all these responsibilities in, you know, this department? And if someone's not on protected leave, and their essential functions have been divvied up 5-6 ways, yeah, that may create a situation where, you know, even if you're out on approved leave, it may mean that by the time you're ready to come back, that the world is sort of kind of different. And I think that's something that many of my clients see claims like that, and there's not an appreciation that it wasn't anything personal. It wasn't about violating the law. It was about a changing dynamic in the workforce.
Now, I think we may have touched on this issue briefly, but if an employee has poor job attendance, been taking a lot of time off, not due to a disability, poor job performance, is not an ideal employee. We've been talking oftentimes about you want to keep it as an ideal employee, but not every employee is the ideal employee. That person may sense something's coming, and they make a request for an accommodation. They announce they have a disability. What does the employer do? Do you investigate? What if you determine this is not an actual disability, that you're being set up? What happens on both sides of this?
Yeah. So from the employer's side, it's a anxiety sort of creating situation, but employers need to stick to the script. If that employee has attendance problems and that's been documented, and then that employee senses it and says, hey, you know, I have a disability, you still go through the interactive process. You document it. And again, you determine whether or not that employee can perform the essential functions of their job. And if they bring a doctor's note saying they can, well, you make the accommodation that you need to, but you still hold that employee to the same standard. And if that employee still continues to fall below expectations despite the accommodation, well, now there's a legitimate business reason for terminating that employee down the road if need be. But many times I will counsel my clients, don't make a snap decision and say that, because most likely that employee is going to Kelly's office. There's going to be a retaliation claim. There's going to be a disability discrimination claim. And you just don't want that. And that's just not the way to adhere to California law. The best thing to do is stick to the script. Any employee that comes in, whether they are a high performer, a below performance performer, you go through the interactive process. You determine whether or not you can accommodate them. And if you can, great. And you hold them to the same standard that you do for any other employee. Because that is what is fair, and that's the appropriate thing to do.
Well, I'm not sure Kelly would take that case, but I'm going to let her answer for herself.
Yeah, I mean, we don't support those types of actions by employees, and we wouldn't want to become involved in a case like that. But you know, if an employee was having attendance issues, I would ask them, well, why is that? Why are you having attendance issues? Is there something about your job that makes you not want to go to work? You know, if that's the case, then perhaps you should find another job. And I just think that, you know, there are also many high-tech startups, especially here in the Bay Area where Michael and I work. They purport to have unlimited time off. And so I've talked to many people that tell me that company policy is unlimited time off, which should allow employees such as the one that you described to be able to take as much time off as they needed without very many conditions, if any. But even though many companies have that unlimited time off policy, it doesn't seem as if anybody ever takes any of the time off. And as Michael knows too, the high-tech startups are working so hard for their big IPO, it's hard for their employees to take time off, let alone key employees. But for someone like that, I would suggest that, you know, if your company doesn't have an unlimited time off policy that you can test to see whether it's for real, then why don't you find a job where you look forward to going to work every day and that you feel passionate about, so that there's not an ongoing issue here.
Absolutely.
Well, we have 10 minutes left. Do you each want to take a few minutes and give some sage wisdom to our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, from the employer's perspective, I think it's important to just remember that when an employee needs an accommodation, you know, take that request seriously, regardless of the circumstances under which it comes to you. From the employer's perspective, you know, go through the interactive process, determine whether or not you can do a reasonable accommodation. And if that means, you know, having multiple conversations, because many times the interactive process is not just one conversation, may mean getting some additional appropriate information from the doctor, checking in, determining what the essential functions are, working with that person's department, but go through that process, right? And remember that you, many instances, employers know this already, they've invested in that person. They want that person to succeed. And so go through that process and do that. And if there are thornier situations where there's a suspicion that maybe, you know, someone's trying to game the system or someone is asking for a request that maybe you may think is unreasonable, that's what I'm here for, right? Feel free to pick up the phone, shoot me an email, give me a call, Mike Wilson at Ogletree Deacons, and I can walk you through that process and how to sort of navigate that request, do it in the way in which the employee's happy, where the company's able to do what it needs to do, and it minimizes risk. Because it is California, and there are a myriad of issues, and so don't think that because you've handled one sort of situation one way that that is going to be a cookie cutter approach to any employee that comes seeking a reasonable accommodation. Take each request seriously, give it the attention it needs, partner with me if you need to walk through that process and make sure that we, you know, avoid any sort of issues. And hopefully what will happen is you are accommodating that employee's happy, that employee's satisfied, and you get goodwill from that. And you help to build your brand as being a workforce that is, you know, a company and a workforce where employees, you know, have wonderful things to say about you. It takes 2 minutes to do that. But of course, if you don't do that, it can do a lot more harm than just you having that one disgruntled employee.
And I would say for an employee that you want to have all of your communications about your disability and need for an accommodation, as well as leave, you want to have all of those in writing and make sure that you have copies of them. I can't tell you how many people I have spoken to through the past 20 years who don't have copies of the things that they emailed their employer after they were cut off suddenly from their email. So I would recommend having everything in writing. I would also recommend that they communicate with their medical providers, including primary care physicians and psychologists, therapists, et cetera, as early on as possible. And also, I would recommend that employees ensure that their medical providers understand that they are coming to them for help with the accommodation process. And if those employees feel as if they're being harassed at work or treated differently because of their disability, it's really important to ensure that that is in the medical records. Because many times medical providers will not have complete notes and not put everything in the notes, and they'll say, employee has work stress. You know, and to my mind, that's a workers' compensation term. And it's just really important to try to get as much detail in the medical records as possible. It's also important for employees going through a difficult time at work and also dealing with disabilities to consider whether going to a psychologist or therapist would help them heal, would help them through the process. And also doing that provides evidence of emotional distress should that come into play down the road. And I'm Kelly Armstrong in San Francisco with the Armstrong Law Firm. And I'd be happy to walk people through that process. Our website is thearmstronglawfirm.com. And when you work with an attorney and you're going through an interactive process, interactive accommodation process, an attorney can ghostwrite things for you and tell you what to write. And then you can send that to the employer, to management, to HR, et cetera. And they don't need to know that you're working with an attorney, but an attorney can help you write things that can create the highest degree of protection for you should that come into play later down the road.
now going to respond to all letters with, did Kelly write this for you? I have one question, and I'll give each of you 60 seconds to respond. Not everyone is the size of apples. Some are mom-pa shops. Some are a little bigger. If you have to investigate an issue of discrimination, disability, accommodation, anything, and somebody's complaining about, do you hire someone outside if you can afford it, or do you do it in-house?
I would recommend that employers do it in-house. And I don't generally like working with outside investigators because employers always pay for the investigators. So to my thinking, there's an implicit bias because the plaintiff's lawyers and people on the plaintiff's side aren't paying for these investigators. And I find that in many instances, investigators say they were unable to corroborate the allegations. So therefore, they conclude the claims are not viable. And that is just not accurate. I would recommend that I prefer an in-house HR investigator, especially because it's much more fun to take their depositions because they don't know as much. But also, when everything is in-house, the internal HR person would know the company and the culture and the people, and the people might feel more comfortable talking to the in-house person as opposed to some hired gun from the outside.
Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, so from my perspective, look, if you're a small mom and pop, it still may make sense to give me a call. Michael Wilson at Ogletree, you know, you can find it at www.ogletreedeacons.com. And I could at least just make sure that you are covering all the steps that you need to do. Because sometimes an internal investigator, if that person is unbiased, will have that connection with the employees. The employees will feel comfortable talking to them, being open and honest, which is all you ever want. And that way, even if maybe the actual allegation is not substantiated, you can make certain changes. But otherwise, if you can afford it, partner with me and we can do that investigation for you so it's unbiased.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been speaking about the topic of employment disability laws. Our guests tonight have been Kelly Armstrong and Michael Wilson Jr. Our show tonight has been produced by Jeff Hayden and at the controls, Damian D. Minor. I'm your host for tonight, Josh Borger at Berliner Cohen. Thank you for joining us. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bay Area, Bars Association Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For more information, you can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org. Uh-huh.